Hello, and welcome to the Mail Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Chris Marshall of the Clickit Comics Library.
In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. The numbers we're going to be talking about in this episode are the top trade sales through Diamond to retailers for February 2014. Again, tons and tons of trades and stuff like that, as we have every month. Really interesting difference, though, this time around between Marvel and DC. If you look at the aggregate sales for the top 300 trades, 38.88% of the units went to Marvel, 43.61% of the dollars to Marvel, not bad. 22.92% of the units to DC. That's about 16% lower than Marvel there. 22.61% of the dollars to DC. That's 21% lower. So, I mean, Marvel did almost twice as many dollars as DC and significantly more units than DC. Mm-hmm. But it took them 137 items on the list to do that for Marvel, compared to the 59 for DC. So, you know, on a per item basis, that's one where looking at the aggregates and looking at the ratios and stuff just paints a very different picture. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, DC's items were both cheaper, sold better, and overall brought in more dollars. So again, perspective, that's what it's all about when looking at these numbers. Some people may cynically take the view of, well, statistics lie or whatever. It's like, no, you can pull different things out of it depending what questions you ask and what questions are meaningful to you. And the other big dog in the race on the trade side is, of course, Image Comics. 14.22% of the units, 10.3% of the dollars. Again, a lot of that Kirkman and specifically Walking Dead. But, you know, you look at the 117,403 total units for Marvel compared to the 69,216 units for DC, and then the 42,933 units for Image. And you can just start to see the kind of the stair-stepping and stuff of just where the top publishers are on this side of the charts.
Was this a down month compared to the other months, or are we starting to see a bounce back from January, you think?
Because
we know January is pretty horrid.
You know, I did that analysis on the comic side. I didn't do that on the trade side. It's a little harder to kind of do some of that long-term on the trade side just because of how the list has shifted stuff.
Well, how did we do on the comic side then?
On the comic side, it was a down month.
Yeah.
Not, you know, oh my God down. It's actually was a much stronger than month than, say, I think 2-3 years ago when the top comic was around the 71,000 mark or something. You know, we still had Batman doing significantly better than that. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, February is usually, as is January, you know, not strong. The first quarter is usually not that strong. People are still coming off the holidays. You know, everybody was trying to get a lot of stuff out near the year end, period and stuff, for the holiday, you know, buying frenzy or whatnot. So there's a little bit of a feast and then famine kind of a situation going on. Mm-hmm. A lot comes out in December. A lot of people have paid for a lot of stuff. They've got to, you know, do that through January, February. And then usually it's, the April, May, June kind of a time frame where things really start to pick up, with July being a really big month. And again, those also tend to be convention months. You know, a lot of publishers, a lot of creators want to have stuff out that's new when they go to these conventions. So, I mean, there are a number of factors that really play into, you know, what's an up month, what's a down month and such. Mm-hmm. But overall, you know, even while this is a down month for the current, you know, short-term kind of a frame or whatever, you know, 2013, like we talked about at the year-end stuff, was a good year. So it's all peaks and valleys and stuff. And again, depends, you know, what perspective matters and what the goal of the question is. You know, if we look at the top 300 list itself, the top selling item did, 4,532 units. That was the Lock and Key Volume 6 Alpha and Omega hardcover. And, you know, 4,500 units is not bad. But for top of the list, we've seen better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, often we've seen significantly better in many, not many, but there have been some months this would have been doing well to get within the top five. But, you know, we've got that. We've got Fatale Volume 4 trade paperback, 4,174 units at rank number 2. Adventure Time Volume 4 trade paperback at rank number 3 with 3,941 units. And then Invincible Volume 19 trade paperback, 3,608 units there at rank number 4. All of those selling significantly less than the previous volumes of them. The most noticeable one of that was Adventure Time number 4, which sold over 60% less than the total known sales of the previous volume. But I think Adventure Time is one of those things that it's not that people are rushing out to go get it the minute it hits the shelf. I think that's got a pretty good shelf life from what we've seen.
Mm-hmm.
There's strong interest in that, and I think this one will, by the time the next volume comes out, Volume 4 will have done pretty well.
Well, and there's definitely an audience, because just below that at rank 8, we've got My Little Pony Tales Volume 2.
Mm-hmm.
And that's done a respectable number at, what do we have, 2874. So, you know, there is an audience for this stuff, for sure, as we've seen month to month.
Now, how much of these do you think are being, I don't want to say propped up, but supported and strengthened by ongoing TV shows? Because both of these have ongoing shows, right?
Yeah, they do. I would say that's a pretty fair statement. You know, but there's also, you know, I don't know much about this title, John, to tell you that, though. You know, this isn't really in my wheelhouse, and I know it's not in yours either.
Yeah.
So it's just one of those things where, you know, are dads ordering this for their kids, or are, in some cases, the adults buying this stuff? You know, it's hard to say. So.
Well, and I think we may see a different pattern between the two, because I can see My Little Pony having more of an adult readership.
Mm-hmm.
There's a person I used to work with. She had the My Little Pony ponies, you know, up at her desk and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Adventure Time is the same way.
Okay, I hadn't realized it would have that kind of a...
Yep, Adventure Time crosses over to more of an adult segment as well.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's not surprising that you've got something that appeals both to kids and to adults, and it's strong because of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I do think there are a number of properties that, you know, I don't say they've cut themselves off at the knees, but have certainly removed a potential segment of their audience just by some creative decisions they made.
Mm-hmm.
Saga, we got volume 1 of that at rank number 5, trade paperback. It's reorder activity, did another 3,604 units, putting its total known reported sales at 91,714 units. And I don't think it would have taken many changes to make that a much more all-ages friendly book.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it would have necessarily lost anything integral to the story. I've had a number of people vehemently disagree with me on that, and, you know, everyone's entitled to their opinion and such. But I've got to wonder if they had made a few of the changes, opened it up to a wider age range, if it would be selling even better than it is, you know, and could they have done that without, you know, drastically compromising, you know, creative integrity or some such?
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, the birth scene or whatever in the first issue, that had to be there. The story's about that character being born.
Yeah.
Maybe showed a little more off-panel, maybe not, you know, whatever. There were a few other things that I think were blatantly mature readers for the sake of being there, not that it added to the story.
Yeah. No, you know, it's interesting you say that, because you wonder if there is an audience for something like that. You know, you watch, like, reruns of The Terminator on Saturday afternoon TV. You know it's cut. You know there's going to be commercials. You know the swear words are going to be out and the violence. Mm-hmm. And you wonder if they could do the same thing artistically for comic books. And, you know, you've got the adult audience for, you know, Lock and Key, for example. And then you kind of strip it down, whereas the 14-year-old kid could read it.
Well, and
you know, it's an interesting dynamic.
It comes down to what is the core of the property,
mm-hmm.
what has to be there without which it is not what it is, and what doesn't have to be there.
Mm-hmm.
The company I'm at, 300, that is kind of ingrained in the company culture in many respects. So, you know, 300 Rise of the Empire came out. They thought it'd be fun to get tickets to various matinee showings, and over a 2-week period, in various sized groups, we you know, headed over to the theater and watched it in 3D and such. And it was one of those things that you know, I'm more than a bit squeamish. I'm exceedingly squeamish, you know, and this movie was very much like the original 300. Slow motion, you know, fight scenes, limbs getting hacked off, blood squirting everywhere kind of a thing. And a little more than I cared for in places, but there was also a side of me as I was watching this in full-blown 3D, not only marveling at how much CG effects have advanced with fluid dynamics, but I just had this image of, like, Heinz Ketchup doing a series of commercials where you've got kids with, like, you know, cardboard tubes or whatever hitting each other and some other kid coming with a squeeze bottle of ketchup to you know, reenact that effect or whatever. And, of course, the silly thing is, kids that age are not allowed to go see that movie because of the violence and the rating and stuff like that. But there's also an aspect of that story, if it had not been told in such a blatantly graphic manner, would have really appealed to a younger male audience, I think.
Right.
And at what point does that property cease to be what it is if you just ratchet back the gore, the violence, or whatever, a little bit? And that's something with you know, various properties, DC and Marvel ones, you know, at what point do you cross the line and this is now a Max or a Vertigo or whatever level of story versus these same characters being in, you know, cartoons for kids?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is no right or wrong answer on that, but from just a brand and property management point of view, I think it's a huge and important decision.
Mm-hmm. It's something worth exploring for sure, yeah.
And again, with Adventure Time, with My Little Pony, we're seeing some definite strengths coming from properties that have opened themselves up to a very wide age range.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I don't know if we talked a little bit about it last week, but, you know, my son's 14 and he's looking for something a little more adult. You know, he reads Green Lantern and everything, and he was really interested in the Image properties, and because he sees what's coming out, you know, he reads the previews and everything. And, you know, really the only thing that, you know, he's kind of done with the one dinosaur book from, Jason Howard and everything, you know, he's kind of outgrowing that. I'm like, so I put it out to Twitter, and really the kind of the only thing that came back was Invincible coming out. That would be a good superhero, or not even it doesn't have to be a superhero. It can be anything, but for that, you know, early teen reader. That's still, I don't really want to expose him to all the sex and violence right away, you know?
I would, frankly, I'd be a little hesitant with Invincible at times.
Well, yeah, that's true. Yeah, absolutely. That's kind of what I'm getting at, yeah. So I might just keep him on Green Lantern. But, you know, we know that there's some sex involved with that, you know, but, you know, especially with the Star Sapphires, the way they're drawn these days. But I'm not being a prude or anything like that. I mean, Lord knows. I've got my, you know, we were talking about canon before we came on. There's plenty of boobs to go around in there, you know.
Well, and again, there's nothing right or wrong about this, but it's a different standard being applied by the publishers today than, say, when I was 14.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I am more squeamish than most. If I had read various scenes from Invincible when I was 14, that would not have worked for me. I would have dropped the title if, you know,
right.
For a number of reasons, you know, as to the why I'm squeamish and whatnot and stuff, but it's,
right.
You know, I've noticed at other times, the level of profanity in certain books, the level of just what's acceptable. And it's not a question of, gee, is somebody a prude? Are they old school values, or are they right? Are they wrong? Or where do you draw that line? But the fact that there is a line to be drawn wherever it is drawn, various people are going to fall on certain sides of that equilibrium or that spectrum or you know, that gradient.
Yeah.
And the more you ratchet in one direction or another, you're going to lose and gain different people.
Right.
So what kind of an audience do you want? You know, do you want one that is into Wolverine because he's just cool or because he is very graphically, you know, slicing and dicing people left, right, and center?
Yeah, the Berserker one. Right, yeah.
You know?
Well, to put it in perspective, when I was 14, you know, the most sex that I saw in a comic book was Elektra. That was about it, you know, with the way she was drawn in her outfit.
There was a little bit from what I've read after the fact of discussion or whatever around an issue of the New Teen Titans where it had shown Nightwing and Starfire having shared the same bed.
Right. I remember that. Yeah.
Didn't show anything that would be, you know, risque or anything of the sort. I mean, she's more risque when she's in costume, frankly. But again, what was acceptable, what was not, what they thought the target audience was. You know, it's could a title like Walking Dead necessarily have been published and considered a mainstream title 30 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't think anyone would argue if it's a mainstream title these days. I mean, it had 2 issues in the top 10 this month.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, whether it's there to stay or not, I don't think so just yet, but it's getting close, you know. But, you know, I look at Adventure Time, My Little Pony, Avatar The Last Airbender, and certain properties like that that are doing fairly strong, certainly on the trade side. I think, you know, targeting a hardcore, in terms of energy level and enthusiasm for a property, audience of younger readers, I think that's not a bad strategy at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the Power Rangers franchise that Paper Cuts is doing some graphic novels and stuff with, or digests or whatever, there's a strong audience for that and a very passionate audience for that. And, you know, if you can tap into that kind of a thing, be it Power Rangers, Transformers, I mean, when Transformers launched from Dreamwave, it launched at the top of the comics chart. You know, toss in some nostalgia, some youthful enthusiasm for a property or whatever, you can really do some astounding sales.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, comics could use that, not only today, but at any point. So, it's interesting how a number of these things that we're seeing kind of near the top of the list, $14.99 trades, again, the $9.99 for the first volume of Saga, mm-hmm. Some stuff like that. I think the entry price point is working out well. We see it again with the $9.99 for the first volume of Federal Bureau of Physics down at rank 13. That did 2,648 units. The first volume of Zero trade paperback, 2,054 units. Yes, the next volume is going to cost a bit more, but again, lowering that barrier to entry, getting people in the door when the story starts, that's just a smart move.
Mm-hmm. I agree. They should be doing more of that across the board, not just with Image or DC or Vertigo, you know, but, you know, Marvel would be smart to do that. But in some cases, they don't have to, you know, so they're not going to do it. But, and maybe it's because they want to put more issues in that trade paperback and not just put 4 in there like, you know, Valiant does with their trade paperbacks or something. So it all depends how much you want to sell and how much you want to sell it for. And if you got the profit margin, then keep on doing it, I guess.
Well, and are you playing the long game or the short game?
Yeah.
You know, if you've got the profit margin or whatever and you can be raking in the bucks and you're playing the short game, that can be a very winning strategy for the mm-hmm. short term. But I think when we see these first issues, first volumes at the lower price, they're playing the long game of let's get them in the door, let's get them on board and make up the money over the long haul. You know, you get something like Walking Dead that's got, 19 volumes out already. You know, sure, could they have made another $5 a copy on that first volume? Definitely. Were they smart not to? I think so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that first volume is at rank 23 on the list, and it's done another 2,116 units of reorder activity, putting its total known sales somewhere above 312,213 units. I mean, that's the long game. That's, you know, Kirkman's success on that title.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Sam and I were talking about this on the comic side of it, and it comes down to, is that a repeatable success? Because that title's been around, you know, 10 years, and frankly, nobody has repeated that level of success.
Mm-hmm. No, not Y, not Fables, you know, but, you know, something, I think something will come along. Maybe not, you know, break the record here, but, you know, there's going to be properties out there that'll come along and, like a Fables, like a Why the Last Man kind of thing, that'll compete for it, I think.
You know, an argument could be made. Saga is starting.
Yeah,
to.
Saga could. Yeah, exactly. I don't think Saga's going to be ending anytime soon. I think Vaughn is in for the long haul on that thing, just like Kirkman is with Walking Dead.
Well, and I think the long haul and having a story that can go for the long haul is a part of it. One of the things I think Saga is doing that's smart is they're taking breathers between arcs. They're planning in those breaks. They're letting people know that. They're setting expectations versus just getting behind. You know, we've seen that on a number of properties over the years. Walking Dead is just one of them. And man, nothing can kill loyalty or burn off goodwill faster than an ill-timed delay. As if there's any delay that's not ill-timed. the big one, these days over at DC is you've heard that, Forever Evil number 7's been delayed.
Yeah.
And it's holding back at least five other books, or five other issues, I should say. And I don't think it's as big of a snowball effect as when Civil War number 4 was delayed. It's still got a lot of people thinking, you know, wow, you know, they totally botched the schedule, can't get, they get their act in a line, in a row, you know, whatever. I would say over the New 52 period, I'd be hard pressed to name other than I think one or two issues, one delayed with the Batman Inc. and one other of one of the Superman titles, Superman Unchained, I think, and the launch, delayed launch of Justice League 3000. Those are the only instances I can think of off the top of my head where they have missed a shipping date. And that's over, you know, 52-ish titles over a 2.5 year period. Yet, you know, one snafu and suddenly it's like, well, you know, can they meet their deadlines? Now, it's not helped by the fact that also over with the Superman, or not the Superman, the Sandman Overture stuff, they've had to resolicit number 2 and they're already canceling and resoliciting number 3.
I saw that too. Yeah, they're having issues with that thing.
You know, it's, what's the right choice? Because you don't want to hold off and get the whole thing in-house before releasing any of it. That's just not as financially sound as you're putting too much at risk if for some reason it either doesn't get completed, doesn't pan out, doesn't sell, whatever. It's not a agile or responsive or lean kind of an approach to publishing. But if you go with a more lean approach and do more of a just-in-time kind of a deal, it doesn't take much to really gum up the works and get delays in the shipping. You know, again, the Sandman Overture is an example of that.
Something to keep an eye on, that's for sure.
Yeah. Now, by the time we get out of, well, not even out of, by the time we get down to rank 30, so we're not even out of the top 30, we're below 2,000 units. And it's not all that much further. I guess it's rank 95, after which we're below 1,000 units. So we very quickly get into a point where not all stores are, on average, even getting a copy of these things. And it goes back, and we've talked about this numerous times. Do all these things need to be collected? You know, how big of a market is there really for some of these things? You know, the volume 2 of the Dial H trade paperback selling, you know, 1,526 copies. The series is over and done with. I think that wraps up everything in it. Did that need to be published or not? Or by not publishing it, could they have driven some interest into the back issues and maybe revived some of that market? And by reviving some of that market, maybe help the sales on the monthly side of just not that title, obviously, it's over, but just in general.
Yeah, I don't know what the contracts are sometimes with these books. That you know, if DC hires writer A, you know, if it's written in the contract saying, hey, you'll get a portion of the trade paperback sales as well, or the hardcover sales. Because, as you know, everything is collected. So it's just a matter of, you know, if it's going to be, if that creator is going to benefit from it. And that's why a lot of the creators, you know, do go on podcasts and do make the rounds of the convention circuit and try to push their own books, because they need to, you know, get a few more dollars in their own pocket sometimes, you know?
Well, I think they should be doing that regardless of the financial incentive on the trades and such. I mean, obviously, they should get royalties or you know, whatever kind of standard compensation for that. But, you know, I expect these guys to be doing the rounds on the podcasts, on the websites, on the convention circuit, just for promoting themselves using their work as a vehicle of doing that.
On the Twitter, on their own Tumblrs, on everything. Yeah, right.
You know, because to a degree, the creator is, I don't say only as good as the last thing they've worked on, but they're only as good as their reputation, and they need to kind of manage that and stuff. I mean, it's a business for them. You know, and there are some guys that do a phenomenal job at that. There are other guys who, you know, not so much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there have been a number of times it's like, you know, I keep hearing this one name, you know, over and over in a short period of time, and it's as if they popped up out of nowhere, and I'll go do a little research, and sometimes they did, other times they've been around for a decade,
yeah.
And I've read a lot of their work, I just, their name never sunk in,
yeah.
You know? So it's, I think, really important for them to do that, because I think the market has become incredibly, we're back, I don't say to a star system, but star power is certainly a factor. When a creative team gets on or off a title, that in and of itself is enough to change the sales. Or at least to get some people to say, well, you know, the creative team I liked is off it, I'm dropping the book, I don't care who's coming on next. And I kind of get that sometimes. Other times, it's like, you're not even going to give the other people a chance. How much did you really like that property, if that's the case? But, you know, flip side, it's usually not the property that people are buying, it's the quality of the story, the art, the actual talent of the creators.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. Yeah, for sure.
So, I do find it surprising at times how almost, mercurial the audience can be. And, you know, often when I look at a chart of a title over the long haul, you know, I can see a very clear turning point. At this point, a new creative team got on, and man, the legs just dropped out from under this title over the course of the next year or what have you. Whether it was a good run or not, again, it changed, and change broke stuff to a degree. So I am seeing a lot of, I think, essentials on the list this time around.
I was going to talk to you about that. There's must have been a reissue in these or something. Yeah, they're all over the place.
All right, now we've had this kind of discussion before where if you look at the retail rank column, you start to see numbers around, you know, 1450, over 1,000, 1687, and stuff like that. And a lot of these, okay, we've got $16.99 and $19.99 price points. Let's pick one of those and kind of filter the list accordingly.
However you want to do it, go right ahead.
Well, let's go with the $19.99 then. It's close to $20. So what I'm seeing is a number of titles. I think I've got about 19 on the list here, all at the same price point, selling from as much as 1,021 units down to 442 units. Now, if a consistent discounting was applied, because the retail rank is the invoiced amount, you would expect that top item of 1,020 units to have the lowest retail rank, i.e. have brought in the most money, and then incrementally be going up at various amounts in kind of in sync with the order index or the quantity, with that bottom one having the highest retail rank, having brought in the least amount of money. And we see that that is very clearly not the case, with, in some cases, items that are selling just a few units shy of each other having almost a 2-to-1 difference in the retail rank. That tells me that certain ones, such as the Essential Power Man and Iron Fist Volume 2, Marvel 2-in-1 Volume 3, and a few others were more aggressively discounted than others. Moon Knight Volume 3, a number of those essentials. So this appears to me to be a case of one of those warehouse sales or whatever. It's like, yep, we uncovered another pallet of these things. Let's blow them out as best we can. And again, nothing right or wrong about that. I think essentials are just a tremendous deal. If you're all right with the black and white nature of them, you just get so much content for such a great price point. That, you know, if they can get them back out into the stores and stuff in sufficient numbers and stuff to please readers, that's just a win-win. If we flip it to the $16.99 thing, actually we see a bit of a different kind of a deal. With these, the retail rank is pretty much like I was describing what you would expect. In this case, Rampaging Hulk Volume 1, that essential, 1,178 units, that's the high. Defenders Volume 4, that essential 467 units being the low, going from a retail rank on that Rampaging Hulk Volume 1 of 672 all the way down towards that Defenders Volume 4 having a retail rank of 1578. The one in there that is out of place is Iron Man Volume 1 with a retail rank of 646. So what that tells me is that one was not aggressively discounted, but all of the others were, but in a much more even kind of a manner. Does that kind of make sense?
Yep, sure does.
It's interesting, though.
How yeah, I mean, it's a little over my head, but no, I know where you're coming from. Absolutely.
Well, what this tells me is the bargain price, the aggressive discounting on the 1699 books was a lot more uniform.
Yeah.
It was pretty consistent across the board, and the retail rank changes in kind of inverse proportion with the units. But it's consistent. Whereas if you look at the 1999 ones, they're bouncing up, down, and left and right between the different ones. There's much less predictability. You go from a retail rank of 1286 to 435 to 1396 to 683 to 750 to 1481. It's just up, down, up, down. So, I mean, there were some that were more aggressively discounted than others, but not, again, in a consistent sort of a manner. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we've got the one at the $24.99, which is the new one, and that's not even an essential, truly. It's a Dynamite book, so my format thing picks up the word essential in the title, because, well, what else did I have to go on? And incorrectly picked that one up. So, but that right there accounts for 25,865 units for Marvel. So it's a decent chunk. Just for comparison, that is more than any publisher other than DC, Image, or Marvel had in terms of trade units for the month. So it's more than all of Dark Horse's trades. Mm. And again, that's stuff that they're just kind of, for the most part, seeming to be kicking out at a decent price, an aggressive discount or what have you.
Anything specific you want to look at today, or?
No, not really. There's just so much of this, and it's getting to where, you know, we're seeing a lot of the same trends in many months. You know, we'll see months where we get these essentials coming. Other months we'll see, you know, not so much. Some months we'll see a lot of things, just at the top of the list above, you know, in this case, again, the high of 4,532, we've got some months we got a lot more up there. Other months, it takes a while to get below the 2,000 units. Here, it's not that there was, I mean, it's just a little bit of a lackluster month.
Yeah, it totally was. I do have a question, and I'm looking it up as we speak here, but, you know, going along the same lines of these essentials, I got a question this week, John, from a guy, and he wanted to know if the essentials were discontinued. And, you know, it's a valid question because you really haven't really seen them pop up. You know, they pop up here and there in the Marvel solicitations every once in a while. Mm-hmm. But they're not as aggressive as they used to be, you know, two or three essentials coming out. I mean, that's one thing you could always bank on was, you know, an omnibus, a masterwork, an essential every month. And
well, roll back about 5-6 years, both the essentials and the showcases, those were in full swing.
Those were hot. Yeah, now they've both of them have gone down. So, you know, my question was, or my answer pretty much was, well, maybe the material, maybe everything's been collected that needs to be collected as they move into the Bronze Age, because those comics, to a certain extent, I'm kind of being biased here, maybe just aren't as good, and they may not sell as well as Marvel would hope, and they kind of know that already. And I'm going somewhere with this. And the other point is maybe that, you know, that's when a lot of crossovers started to happen, so it may not be smart to collect it all as an essential. Maybe they need to do something more. And that's where these epic collections are coming in. And we're seeing, you know, Marvel did announce this big, giant initiative to have these epic collections. And they're, you know, pretty big trade paperbacks. This time around, this month, we've got Captain America Dawn's Early Light coming at rank 122. And these trade paperbacks are full color. This one's $35, $34.99. and it did 866 units. Well, looking at what this thing collects, if I can find what it collects, this is the Roger Stern run, which is a pretty great run, actually. You know, collecting Captain America 247 through 266, and
That was some good stuff, yeah.
yeah, and Captain America Annual number 5. So it's almost like, you know, in 496 pages. So there is as big as Inessential,
Full
but here
color?
they're,
Full color?
full color.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I'm not, I've seen reaction to the quality of these books. You know, some like them, some don't care because you're getting so much for the money kind of thing. And others want, if they're going to do this, they should do it a little more quality, maybe paper stock a little bit heavier, I think. So I've, you know, it's both ways, but I think what Marvel's trying to do with these, and this one is actually Captain America: The Epic Collection, Volume 9. However, we know it's the first Captain America Epic Collection, so I'm not even sure how the logic of how they're even collecting these books. But they're doing it for you know, all the big players with Iron Man and Cap and Thor and the Avengers, and yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how well these hold up. Especially if they're, you know, I don't know, I don't see these as big sellers at 866 copies for that kind of money. I mean, that's a pretty expensive volume compared to the other items where this book falls on the list. You know, there's a lot of 1499 books, a lot of 1999 books,
But that's where the retail rent comes into play.
and the exact that's what I was gonna yeah that's what I was gonna touch on with you. If you want to talk a little bit more about that with this book or and similar books like it, like the Omnibus, the Deadpool one, you know, or is that
Yeah,
the
it's one of those things that this ranked at 122 in terms of quantity rank, but it was at 58 for the retail rank.
58 for the retail, right?
So, I mean, there are a couple others that are even further below it on the list. The Golden Age Captain America, Omni or whatever hardcover down that was a $125 item. That was the fourth best grossing, item this time around, you know? So it can sell less because of the higher price point and make more money. The question I would have is, depending on that paper quality and some other stuff, 500, almost 500 pages in color. I mean, that's got to cost a significantly more to print than, say, that item right above it of that Essential Fantastic Four Volume 1, which was just black and white and a similar page count.
Yeah.
So I think that kind of a page count in color is a great idea. That in and of itself, I think, would almost kill off the Essential or Showcase type lines. I disagree with your assessment that they have kind of collected all that's worth collecting. I do agree with your comment that you get into some challenges with the crossovers and aspects of that. But I think there's a number of different ways to kind of go solve that.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think that the Epic Collections, instead of starting with the Roger Stern run here, if they should have gone back to, you know, the Silver Age and collect the Tales of Suspense Cap and gone right, you know, make basically what people want, color essentials, and start with the number ones and go through the Bronze Age and everything, you know?
I don't think so. I think they started at a good point.
Okay.
Because, I mean, how many issues are in there?
Let's see, 247 through 266 and the annual number 5. So, you know, a good 23 issues or so.
So about 2 years worth almost.
Yeah.
You know, you go from that point and then just start working your way forward.
Or backward. You know, I don't know
Or
if
both.
this is volume number 9 of the Epic of the Cap Epic Collections. It sounds like this is the middle of the road, right? They're gonna have to go back. Or
That
maybe
part
not. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see what volume the next volume is going to collect.
that does puzzle me to start at 9.
Yeah.
That implies they've got plans for 8 previous ones plus ones after. But then why start there if you're not going to kind of move forward? I would start around that time and move forward, figuring the older stuff has already been collected between the Masterworks, Essentials, other places. I do think that there is a period of stuff in the 70s, 80s, and 90s that has not been collected at both Marvel and DC. And I think that is kind of the next area for them to go digging for stuff, because there's a lot of great things there. I've also got to wonder if the advent of digital and opening up that market has completely changed the game, where it is better for Marvel and DC to go through and do the legwork to do essentially this kind of a collection, figuring that gives them everything they need to also release those issues digitally if they couldn't already. I've got to imagine that we are not that far away, 5 years, 10 years tops, before they will essentially have a digital library in-house at Marvel and DC of everything they've ever done.
Yeah.
And then it's just a question of how do they recollect that into new and interesting ways.
Okay, so here is an explanation from Marvel what these are. Marvel launches the Epic Collections, a new way for fans to collect their favorite series. Each supersized volume in the Epic line presents a heaping helping of Marvel's greatest heroics in one handy, affordable, and self-contained package. What's more, each Epic Collection trade is also a piece of the grand puzzle. When it is all said and done, the Epic volumes will seamlessly fit next to one another on readers' bookshelves, presenting a complete and unbroken run of each title. So be sure to get on the ground floor. Marvel's most storied titles, including Spider-Man, Avengers, Cap, Fantastic Four, Iron Man, and Thor, are going Epic. So, for, like, coming up, the Fantastic Four Epic Collection, All in the Family, it's coming out. Oh, let's see. It's book 17 of Fantastic Four. It is coming out, or just came out in February. Okay, this book collected Fantastic Four 296 through 307, annual 20, and the Fantastic Four versus the X-Men 1 through 4. I mean, eventually this stuff will collect. It's kind of like
that's an
oversight. You know what
place
it is?
To have it's, started.
It's weird. It's yeah. It's almost like, you know, yes, it's a Color Essential or a, you know, soft cover Masterworks that are triple in size kind of thing. So
where does that line up to where they had left off with the Essentials and the Masterworks for Fantastic Four?
Fantastic Four is at, I probably can tell you in a minute here.
I'm just wondering if they picked this, started these collections up where the others had kind of trailed off. Because with Fantastic Four, I personally probably would have gone back to more the John Byrne era.
Yeah.
And started with that, because I think that would have been a stronger start for it. But the whole concept of getting to where you've got a series of trades that would go on your shelf and give you the complete run in color of everything, that sounds pretty cool. And at, you know, $35 for a 2-year run, price-wise, that's not too bad.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my question is, yes, I kind of gloss over the trade section on the Marvel previews. Was this something that you were really aware of was coming out, or?
I remember the press release from last year.
Okay.
But you know, I didn't really know what other than that blurb, they didn't say color double size trade paperback, you know. But just to give you an idea of where the Masterworks are right now. Fantastic Four Masterworks Volume 16 is collecting 164 through 175. And this one is, you know,
end of the 200s, yeah.
End of the 200s, going into 300s. So
there's like a 100-issue gap in there.
Yeah, yeah. So it all depends on what you want. So
I don't know. That just strikes me as very odd.
Yeah.
Why pick up there? Is that just the start of
And it's
story
not like they're touting it. Like, remember the Visionaries a couple years ago?
Uh-huh.
Where Marvel would say, like, the John Byrne Fantastic Four Visionaries or something. You know, you'd get that double title of, yeah, they're touting Fantastic Four, but, oh, this is John Byrne's Fantastic Four kind of thing. You know, you're not getting that here. You're not getting it's the John Byrne Iron Man Epic Collection War Games that's coming out next week, you know, that's collecting, that's volume 16, that's collecting Iron Man 258 through 277, you know, if anybody wants to go out and look on Amazon, they're all listed right here of what's out, and a few of the ones that are upcoming in 2014, but yeah, it's something to keep an eye on, for sure.
I would have gone.
And maybe next month we can go through and write down and see how these have done over the previous months, you know, and kind of track these.
Yeah, that would be interesting. It would also be worth, again, seeing for a couple of these titles, Fantastic Four, Captain America, and whatnot, what range of issues have been collected in the different formats. You know, have they double and triple dipped on the early issues, skipped 100-issue range, those sorts of issues.
Now, it's interesting, the Avengers one is probably the closest one. The Avengers Masterworks is on volume 14, and that collects 129 through 135. And the Epic Collection, The Final Threat, is at 150 through 166. And
so it's as if they started
out last December,
a volume off or whatever. It just seems to me if they had done better branding on this and really played up, this is going to be the full timeline of the title. They could have gotten, frankly, I think a lot more people hooked. This had kind of skated under my radar. Not that I'm really big into the trades and such, but if I could have had a here, you know, collect these and you'll have the full run of Cap, of Iron Man, of Thor, of, you know, X-Men, Avengers, you know, Fantastic Four and Spider-Man or whatnot in color, I'd have considered it. But starting with the issue numbers they did, both in terms of the volume numbering, which is odd, and then none of those issue ranges jump out at me as, oh yeah, I would have started there because that was when this happened or something.
Right.
But I've been thinking for years they needed to do that kind of a timeline and such. It's just, you know, here's the full run and you know, we'll go in and out as best we can. I think this would be the same sort of approach if you were to do a little more in terms of varying lengths. Collect everything that is, you know, what came out in a given week, 2 weeks, or whatever period. You know, imagine if you could do a Marvel time capsule or whatever, and here's everything from the first week of 1980, and then the second week, and the third week, and the fourth week. You know, I don't know how big of an audience that would have, but I think it'd be an interesting way to do it.
That's one thing you can look up on your own, though, thanks to, like, Comic Book DB. Or, you know, you can look at, see what came out that month, and then if you want to, I don't know if they link over to Comixology or anything like that, but you could go to Comics, you know, write your list down and go over and, you know, read all the comic books that came out the week you were born, you know, or, you know, every year for your birthday. What came out the week of your birthday? You know, me being 43 years old kind of thing. You know, that might be kind of fun to do.
That's something that,
you know, I
think would be really
to do that,
cool to have. and Comic Book DB is close to it.
Yeah.
But being able to say, it's like, okay, I remember this issue, and somewhere within a few month range, there was this other story. I know it had characters X and Y, but I don't remember what issue it was.
Yeah.
You know, and have it kind of help, you know, or whatever. That would be very useful. But that's the kind of thing I would almost expect to be as much available at maybe Comic Vine, where I think they've got a slightly, not bigger and better database. It's a different nature of a database. It's got an API and stuff, but I think between Comic Vine, Comic Book DB, which is an excellent resource, the Grand Comic database, and, you know, there are a few others out there. There's a wealth of that kind of information to be had. But I do think it would be interesting for the main couple of lines and stuff over at Marvel and DC, mainly Marvel, what level of overlap and coverage do they have between the different ways they've collected the essentials, the masterworks, and so forth? You know, are there certain chunks that they've just collected ad nauseum and others they just have avoided? Because I do think there is a range in the 80s and 90s where finding a good entry point and exit point to collect a trade would be tough.
Yeah.
But I think that's also why we had a very different sales dynamic at the time, because there were more narrative threads keeping you in the title, be it subplots or what's going on with the villain, the lead character, the supporting cast, whatever, versus today where you've got 4, 5, or 6 issue arcs by and large, beginning, middle, the end, clean close, come in with a clean open on the next issue. Well, that's a jumping off point right there, you know, whereas you never really got that kind of a clean story break, you know, 20 years ago.
Well, and another thing that, you know, I just caught myself thinking about this, looking at all the essentials that have been reissued and reordered on our list this month, and talking about the Epic Collections and the Masterworks, you know, pretty much when the Masterworks go out of print, they go out of print. And I don't know if they're going to do the same thing for these Epic Collections.
Well, it just seems to me that they've got an inconsistent, or one that's changed over time, is probably the more charitable way to say this, way of collecting titles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it makes sense to do the masterwork stuff for the Golden Age, the early Silver Age, that kind of stuff. When you start to get more towards the 80s and 90s and such, it's a little harder to swallow those kinds of price tags for these collections.
Yeah.
They've done the essential, but, you know, it's not the same without the color.
Mm-hmm.
But then they've also done, you know, the classic series for like Invaders and a few other titles. They've done, just the one-off kind of, volumes and such that they keep renumbering when new creative team comes on board and stuff. Having something that does a unified timeline. I mean, with like Captain America here, it'll be interesting if they were to extend this beyond that first volume. How do they handle it when he had two titles?
Mm-hmm.
You know, do they include some of the side miniseries with this? Do they not? You know, how does it play out when they get up to, let's see, what issue does that was, for that Captain America one, what was the last issue number in there?
I just lost it. I'm sorry.
It's all right. No. You told me and I've forgotten it. So.
Oh, no.
Because I know around 313, which seems like it'd be a volume or two after that at least, they crossed over the Captain America title, kind of intersected a little with the Squadron Supreme stuff.
Well, that had one issue.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've got that. I've got that one in front of me. This one goes 247 through 266.
So roughly 24 issue runs. Yeah.
But, you know, but as you mentioned that, looking at the Spider-Man one, which is the Cosmic Adventures, which is coming out, or this came out last December. This might be a good one to look up eventually for next month. This collected, I don't have a volume number on this one, but it says it collected Amazing 226 through 333 and Annual 24. Spectacular 158 through 160 in Annual 10, and Web 59 through 61 in Annual 6. So this covered that whole Cosmic Adventure storyline that ran through all the books there.
Yeah, for Spider-Man, you've got to go through the rotating titles he had.
Yeah.
The stories jumped around. You would have an inconsistent narrative otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we'll have to do a little digging on this, because you've really got me curious as to, do they have some large gaps? And then if they do, I mean, I guess with the Epic line, given a 2-year-ish, 24-issue-ish size per, is it pretty obvious how this would segment out going back? In other words, if this is volume, what you said, 19 or something?
Something like that, yeah.
Can we figure out where the breaks would be for the other 18?
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I mean, could. Man, you multiply that out, $35 times, you know, 20 at least, because we know there's going to be more or whatever. I mean, that starts to get to a decent chunk of change. But if they've got a good trade dress, it looks consistent on the shelf, it's in color and stuff. Again, $35 per, and you can make it cheaper if you get these things through like in-stock trades, DCBS, Amazon, wherever. This is not a bad way for people to get a lot of this older stuff in a collected volume.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, it's just the bizarre way how they do it. They're starting, you know, Spider-Man's got volume 15 and 20, Avengers volume 9 and 17, Fantastic Four 17 and 20. You know, just kind of strange how they're starting middle of the road here. So
it almost, I was going to say, there had to be a reasoning behind this.
Mm-hmm.
It would almost seem like they thought those would either sell the best or would be the easiest starting points or new creators or something, but it does seem haphazard.
Mm-hmm.
I would be very curious to know what the game plan was on this.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I can dig something up at C2E2.
Yeah.
Find out. Yeah. You know.
But as somebody who got a lot of the Masterworks, who got some of the Essentials and such, them going to yet another format for this, as cool as it may sound, is a little off-putting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that having been said, they do an epic collection of the Marvel Handbook. I'm all over that.
Oh, I'd be all over that, you know.
And this
both
is
the first one and the deluxe one and the, you know, includes the update 89 and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be great.
Yeah, this is, I'd be all over that. I double-dipped on the single issues and got the original set of trades for these and then got the essentials for these.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'd do it again, but they have to put those out.
Well, and the essentials, I mean, they almost have to be color because it's one thing to read Green Lantern as a showcase because you're getting the story, but in this, and we've talked about this before, the visuals in the handbooks, you've got to see the colors on the costumes and see what the makeup is.
I would actually almost argue the reverse of that.
Really?
Green Lantern, if it's not yellow and I can't see it's yellow, it's just hard to understand why he can't get past something. Yeah. Color matters in that.
No, it does, right.
Whereas with the handbook stuff, getting just the black and white art gives aspiring colorists perfect templates to, you know, how can they color this costume well? Do you need it as reference? Yes, certainly. I completely 100% agree with it, but I actually see a value in a black and white version of those.
Yeah.
And I mean strictly black and white, not grayscale.
Well, that's like, you remember I'm not sure what it was they were exactly called, but they did the handbook, but it was in a spiral-bound notebook.
It was loose leaf. It was the master edition.
The master, yeah, and you had like the front, back, and side view of the character.
Yeah, those were model sheets, and simple.
Yeah.
It was uninspired art, but in terms of reference,
oh,
awesome.
Fantastic. Yeah, really, really good.
I wish they could find a way to make those kinds of reference books practical and doable these days.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't seem to do them as comics. They can't seem to really make them fly, as far as I can tell, as role-playing game supplements.
Is that something that companies do themselves, just in-house?
Which?
Doing a master edition in-house and just keep it in-house. Like, if, you know, for example, you know, Valiant revamping all their characters. You think there was some kind of style guide or style sheet for the characters that they all kept it, since, you know, it is going to be a shared universe, these characters are going to be crossing over eventually, that they have the reference material for the different artists?
Oh, certainly. If you look at if you look in Valiant's case at the character covers or whatever they called those a while back, that's exactly what some of those were.
Okay.
This is what Bloodshot looks like. This is what Archer looks like. This is what Armstrong looks like. If you look at some of the directors.
But, like, I mean is like front, back, side kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They had character model sheets or whatever. I forget exactly what they called those variant covers.
Oh, cool.
But they did that for a number of the Valiant books early on. So, yes, they had the art lying around because they put that together. You look at the director's cut for Marvel and DC for various things. Often you'll get those kinds of, you know, the artist kind of sketching out what the character was going to look like, the design sheets or whatever. I mean, if I were publishing comics, I would definitely want to have that. Because if I were to get a new artist on board or whatever, I want something I could hand them and basically you're going to work on book X. Here's this PDF that gives you everything you need to know, how the characters look, how they act, you know, whatever it may be. Not something that's just gargantuan volume of information. Something that's short, concise, to the point, and gives them exactly what they need to know. And frankly, is a bit of a living document. As things change, as they get updated, as artists tend to have particular problems, particular questions, you update that. Because I have heard stories where artists are having to draw, you know, some Marvel crossover, some DC team book or whatever, and they're getting, you know, either sent a reference image or whatever, or comic or whatever, and it's, so-and-so showed up in this issue. And I don't know if it was in one of the DVDs I've got that was interviewing George Perez or if it was somewhere else entirely, but I think it was Perez, was working on a thing, and he was pointed in a particular direction. I forget if he had just had the issue or whatnot, but he was looking for, like, what does the back of this character's costume look like? Mm-hmm. And the issue that they were given as reference didn't have a clear shot of the back of the character. And it's like, that's of no use. And do you want to have to remember how every artist, what angle they drew, every panel of every con? It's like, no, just have a reference, a model sheet.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm the kind of guy who gets a little annoyed when the Batcave looks different every time we see it.
Right.
or the Jean Grey school suddenly has new buildings it didn't have before. You know, the last Weekly Comics Spotlight, one of the things I noticed about the new $6 Million Man comic, and I'm not 100% certain on this because I haven't done the research to check, I'm pretty sure the artist got the layout of Oscar Goldman's office right.
Mm-hmm.
Does that matter? No. Does it make the book feel right, feel more real? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And anything that gives a reader a, oh, this isn't quite right feeling, one more thing to kick him out of the title.
Yeah.
And with sales that we're seeing, do we need another reason to kick somebody out of a title? I don't think so.
That totally reminds me of, it just happened this week on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, how they brought Kevin Bacon back.
I saw that. I saw a clip of that, yeah.
Now, what they did on, I think it was BuzzFeed or something like that, they spliced together his dance routine from The Tonight Show and the exact same scene they did in Footloose the movie.
Shoot me a link to that. I was wondering.
I will shoot you a link to that. It was a side-by-side comparison, and it was, and sure enough, you know, from the bow tie to the drinking beer to the, you know, the cigarette. I mean, everything was spot on. You know, it was hilarious. So, yeah, I will try and find it. It's on Facebook somewhere. I'll
kudos to Fallon for doing that. Kudos for Bacon for pulling it off.
Oh, it was awesome. It was, yeah.
I mean, can you imagine if somebody told Kevin Bacon 30 years ago, you're going to be on The Tonight Show. It's going to be hosted by somebody who's like, what, in kindergarten at that point, I would imagine.
Well, Kevin Bacon's 55 now, yeah.
Well, but how old is Fallon?
Fallon's 30, almost 40, I think.
So he would have been 10 at the time. So, yeah, this 10-year-old, you're going to be back on The Tonight Show. He'll be hosting, and you're going to recreate this entire sequence there. Trust me, people will go nuts. Yeah, I don't think anyone would have bought that. That's just funny. But yeah, getting that kind of attention to detail, that kind of minutia right, helps.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that's part of why I'm such a big fan of George Perez, is Titan's Tower, when he was doing the title with Marv Wolfman, had a consistent layout. You could go through those comics and project those out into, you know, what they would look like in 3D, and you would have a cohesive model, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Same with his rendition of the Baxter Building, Avengers Mansion, any other title he worked on. It had a physical reality to it. You know, the complete other end of the spectrum is kind of the jokes on Rob Liefeld, where the door keeps changing which wall it's on, you know? So it's, yeah. To me, that's something that's important. It helps keep readers in the narrative world, and we need more of that.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
So... All right, so top 300, bottom of that list is at 442 units. That was the Essential Moon Knight Volume 3 that we talked about. We had another couple of items, another two dozen or so that kind of below the radar. Again, what happens is they give the top 300 trades, they do small trades, they do indie trades, and that's just like the top 50 things not by Marvel and DC and whatnot. So I'm able to fill in a couple of intermittent slots, in this case going down as far as 406, and that item was from First Second. It was Love and Hell Volume 2 graphic novel, reorder activity, 346 units. So again, you know, there's stuff happening below the radar that's of interest. Another volume of Adventure Time was in there. That's about the most exciting thing in there. Superbia Volume 3, it did 429 units. So, and there's some great stuff happening down in this area, but I think, given where sales are at, I question how many of these things really need to be coming out as collected editions.
Mm-hmm.
Most prevalent price point this time around was the $14.99 price point. We had 70 items there. That was 23 1/3 of the percent of the items on the list. Second most prevalent was $19.99 with 68 units, only a two-item difference there. Those two account for 46% of the list. Add in the 37 items at the $16.99 price point. Now we've covered 58 1/3 of the list. We had another 26 items at the $24.99 price point. Now we've covered 67% of the list. Another two dozen at $17.99, bringing us up to 3/4 of the top 300. We had a tie with 10 items apiece at $29.99 and $34.99. And then from there, we're in single digit number of items, per price point. We've got 8 at, $12.99 and $9.99. And let's see, another 7 at $15.99. Yeah, so that's the majority of it. We got a couple of things here and there. Most expensive on the trades list this time around was $125. That was the Golden Age Captain America hardcover volume one we talked about. It was not the most expensive item this month, though. You're like, wait, John, you just said that was the most expensive item on the trades list. Yes, that's right. There was a more expensive item on the comics list at rank 377 for $199.99, you too could get the complete Villain Month's 3D Motion complete set. And in hindsight, I'm probably thinking, yeah, maybe I should have gotten that. I successfully avoided the 3D hoopla I am okay with that.
Yep.
So, a lot of good stuff. Again, I just think that maybe more things getting collected than maybe needs to be. You know, it's got a price to move these things through the system, and if they're using this as a way to get everything prepped to go digital, that makes sense. If it if it is not, then I question the need for it. So,
well, it keeps us in business. So,
true. Speaking of business, what do you got coming up on your show?
What do I got coming up on my show? Not much. You know, I guess the biggest thing, I didn't have a show last week. I was just so bogged down with work, and I had a presentation, and I had to go to Toledo for work, and it's one of those things that, you know, that keeps you up at night, and just, you know, being sick to your stomach, and is it going to be okay? So I'm like, you know, instead of forcing an episode and not practicing my presentation, I decided to actually work and, you know, get some work done at night. So I pulled off my presentation on Friday. It was good. But on the way home, I blew a tire in a pothole. Ooh. And I also ruptured my front and rear struts.
Ouch.
And so, yeah, changing a tire on the side of a highway at rush hour traffic in Detroit is not fun, especially when you're in your suit. But thank God it was relatively warm out at 43 degrees or so and sunny. But yeah, that just wasn't fun. And then, of course, I had to bring it to the shop, and I noticed that, you know, if I'm going to do one tire, I might as well do all four tires and to do my struts. So yeah, it was a good $2,000 day this past Saturday. But you know, get back to your question. For this week on my show, I'm going to talk a little bit about DC. You know, DC always had these massive lists that of upcoming books, you know, going through all the way through July of 2015. Mm-hmm. And they do it twice a year, one in the fall, one in the summer. And sure enough, this one came out a few weeks ago. You know, so I'm not going to really touch on the new 52 trade paperbacks or hardcovers because we kind of know about that, but I'm going to touch on a little bit of the showcases, some of the omnibuses that, or the absolutes they're going to be talking about, like Absolute Brightest Day, which should be an interesting collection, the Absolute collected Haunted Night, which is the third book of the Jeff Loeb, Tim Sale. You know, they did Dark Long Halloween, Dark Victory, and then, you know, before they did that, they did a 3-issue series of Halloween issues, and that's what kind of led to Haunted Night.
Those were part of the Legends of the Dark Knight series.
The Legends of the Dark Knight stuff, yeah. So they they're collecting that and Catwoman When in Rome into one omnibus. So if you line them all up, you're going to have the complete run of the Jeff Loeb, Tim Sale Batman, which is really going to be cool. And I've been clamoring for that for a couple of years now. And if you've never read the Catwoman book, that's awesome. That ranks right up there.
So, yeah, I read all that stuff when it was coming out. It was some great stuff.
So good. And you know, those three individual Halloween books they're not that easiest to find. I mean, yeah, you can go on eBay if you want to, but if you want to have the fun way of going out into a back issue bin at a convention and hunting them down, you know, that takes some doing. And so it'll be nice collecting the oversized, you know, like that. So
cool.
I'll be doing that. What about you? What's coming up on your show?
Same old, weekly comic spotlight every week with Drew. That's going great. Enjoying that stuff quite a bit. We're going to talk about this coming episode, Red Hood and the Outlaws number 29.
Will Pfeiffer's book. Excellent.
I'm looking forward to that. Let's see.
You will see Will in Chicago. He is, he lives in Chicago.
Oh, cool.
And he is an awesome, awesome guy. You're going to love him. So
good deal. We've also got Uncanny X-Men number 19. Now.
Nice.
And then in the other slot, what we currently have slated as the two of us here record this is Loki Ragnarok and Roll number 2. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say currently have slotted is I just got my DCBS shipment this evening. We're recording this Monday night. Normally I get it Friday night, but yeah, UPS was slow, whatever. And I don't have Loki Ragnarok and Roll number 2. So I'm gonna see what I can do about that, and hopefully we can review it, because I loved the first issue there.
That was a good issue. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've reached out to Oni, seeing if I can get like a PDF review copy just to tide me over till DCBS can get me my copy. Hopefully I'll hear back from them either tomorrow with a copy or with a no, can't do it, sorry. Hopefully they'll come through. I just basically said, hey, I want to review your stuff. I've got it. It'll go up Monday. Will that help? And if I need to, I'll go see if I can find it at the local stores. But it's one of those things. It's been out for about a week. I don't know how well a mini series from Oni is getting stocked at a few of these stores. There's Austin Books, I think, has a good chance of having it. Not a great chance, but even if they have it, can I find it? I hate their genre racking. I'll probably just head there first. If I need to, I can double back to Capstone Comics and look around. But in addition to that, obviously last week the comics episode of The Numbers went up. Great discussion with Sam. Really enjoying that stuff too. And
Well, you and
then.
Drew, just talking about your show, you and Drew, I caught the it stood out because I really, really enjoyed this book, and I'm glad you guys enjoyed it too. And that was the new Moon Knight.
I was really blown away by that. He was really
Yeah.
jazzed about doing it. It's like, okay, we'll do this. The last few Moon Knights, yeah, not so much for me. They had a very interesting approach, very Batman-centric, very different visual,
Yeah.
but I could knock it, oh, it's derivative, whatever. Regardless, it was really good.
It was good. Yeah, I was really surprised.
It's probably a better Batman book than I've read in many Batman titles, actually. But it was cool, and it was one of those, as I was starting it, there were a number of things that were highly mockable, but it's like, this is a very interesting take on just a street-level character in general. It works fine for Moon Knight. They acknowledged where the character had been. Yeah, I'm looking forward to more of that.
And they acknowledge he's a little crazy, so
Yeah.
there's no doubt about that.
Marvel's doing a lot of interesting stuff with the Marvel Now and the all-new Marvel Now, and then whatever's the newer version of the Marvel Now that we'll get in a few months. And I'm not thrilled by the constant relaunching in the number ones, but a lot of these things are really good stories, and that's what I'm in the comics for. I get frustrated by the numbering shenanigans and the cover gimmicks and stuff like that, but I'm into the stuff because I love to read comics.
Hey, speaking of gimmick, we're not going to talk until after the Captain America movie comes out, and so hopefully we can talk a little bit about that on the next show, because I know you're probably going to go see it, right?
I usually wait for the DVDs.
Oh, you're going to kill me. All right.
I'll see what I can do. I'll see.
You saw the first Captain America movie, though.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I'll definitely see it at some point. It's got Robert Redford in it. It's got a good cast. My sister's interested. If they're going to do this one in 3D, right?
I won't go see it in 3D. I don't see live action movies in 3D anymore. It's too dark for me.
I can understand that.
Yeah, it just is. I'd rather go see it up close and bright lights. And
My point is,
I think I saw like 300 in 3D, and that just set me off. It was so dark, with the glasses and the, yeah,
yeah.
just awful.
Well, it's funny. I just saw 300, Rise of the Empire in it in 3D
Yeah.
and stuff. And there are times 3D gives me a headache or whatever. This one, it
Yeah.
worked fine. The bottom line is, I think it's got a good enough draw that my sister's interested in it. I don't like going to the movie theater myself. So if I've got somebody to go with, that certainly helps.
See, I'll do that.
So I'll see what I can do. I'm not making any promises. I'm not making any guarantees, but
Yeah. After 15 years of marriage, my wife and I go to the movie theater together and we go see separate movies.
That's funny.
It's awesome. It's
If that's not the secret to a successful
greatest
marriage, I
marriage
don't know
ever.
what is.
That's
That's
great.
funny.
We've done it probably like 3 or 4 times in our marriage, and it's
I'm
fun.
not gonna I'm not gonna tell that part when I tell the story at work tomorrow.
No, that's all right. That's cool. But no, I wanted to tout, being that we're not going to be talking till after Captain America, if anybody out there is interested in learning more about the Falcon and Sam Wilson, my last podcast was just that. I talked about the Falcon and Captain America trade paperback that came out, I think it was the first week of March. And this collected all of the Sam Wilson. Like his origin story, collected the 4-issue mini that was really, really good. His first solo one, his first backup, a lot of the firsts for Sam. And there were some great extra features in the back too, that I go over that is not listed on the trade paperback. They include the Marvel Handbook entry and a few other pinups in there, which are really neat. So it was a really, really great trade for the money and a really, really great introduction to the character if you're not familiar with it. I bought it, John, for my son.
I can see that. That's a good, good one.
It is a perfect. If you've got a kid out there and he's going to go to the movie with you and he wants to learn more about the Falcon, this trade paperback is right up your alley. It's really been
ages since I read that miniseries of his back in the 90s. But
yeah,
that's one of those when people say, oh, the Marvel 90s, it was horrible. It's like, no, they did some great stuff around that time frame. Falcon is just. He's a cool character, great visual. That's one of the things that's got me excited about the movie too.
Totally, yeah.
Well, and the other thing we both have coming up, you mentioned earlier, C2E2.
Yep, coming up end of April.
I'm going to be there. You'll be there, so we'll be hanging out some together. Certainly any listeners who are out there, come and say hi. I want to put faces to names and such like that.
We have an easy way to find us at the mass confusion that is C2E2 because I will be holding fort at the Tomorrow's Publishing booth. So come up and say hello, and John, you'll be hanging around. And
I'll be there on and off seeking refuge from the craziness as I get tired.
Absolutely. We aren't really doing a podcaster alley this year. Before 11 o'clock comics kind of owned that area. I don't think Pants is coming in from CGS.
Oh, that's too bad. I was looking forward to hanging with
him. Yeah, I don't think
Brian
he is,
Christmas
so.
Is a he's a great guy. I love hanging with him.
Yeah, so I'm going to put it out there, and really none of the guys from 11 o'clock comics are going out there. So
tell me all this was decided before I decided to go to C2E2.
No.
It's not because I'm coming. They're bailing.
No, they're all going to – and Derek Howard's coming in from Comic Book Noise. I'm driving in with Derek. And they are all going to Heroes Con in a large contingent. That seems to be where they're going this year, which is I can
understand that. That's one of the other ones on my list of ones I want to go to.
Yeah,
but
totally.
I've never been to a Chicago convention. Got some friends in Chicago. They said, "Hey, you want to stay with us and stuff and go to the convention?" They're big on the convention stuff too. And I'm like, "Yeah, actually, I do want to do that this year." So I got some friends I'll be hanging with, but it'll be fun. I want to do the C2E2 experience.
Yeah, and I know there's, you know, podcasters always kind of hang around Artist Alley because kind of they're one of the same, but I don't know if there's going to be a podcaster area. At least if there are, I might not know who these new podcasters are. So if you want, hey, come and hang out at Tomorrow's booth, and, you know, you can always put your bag under there and keep it safe if you want to walk around and get something to eat. That can be a central meeting point for a lot of guys. So, and come by and say hello for sure. So
yeah, that'll be cool. I'm looking forward.
And we're going
to
be located. And a lot of podcasters know this guy. Brian Stringer is going to be there doing his tattoo parlor. And from what I understand, we are directly across from Brian Stringer. So easy to find, right near Tattoo Alley kind of thing. So
a tattoo alley. Interesting. Okay.
Oh,
I can
Brian's
already
got it.
Tell
got it
it's going to be a little different than San Diego.
No. Brian's got it set up. He's got a crazy operation. He listens to my show. He listens to 11 o'clock comics. Great, great guy. So
cool.
Yeah. So definitely. It should be a lot of fun. So yeah, I'll be there Thursday night and leaving Sunday. So
I'm looking forward to it because, again, most of my convention going experience, I've been to like MegaCon. I've been to, mainly San Diego actually, but I've been to Dragon Con and a few others, but about 30 years of San Diego.
Yeah.
So going to a different convention in a different part of the country that has hopefully different vendors, different cool things to go see. I'm looking forward to that. Hanging with some other podcasters and such like yourself that I just don't see enough of. That's going to be a lot of fun.
Well, their Artist Alley is fantastic. I mean, it's probably from what I don't go to a lot of conventions, but from what I hear from guys that do travel, and John, I'll be interesting to get your perspective on this going from San Diego to Chicago, is what you think of the Artist Alley, because it's wide open. Guys are really friendly, really accessible. So
I think you'll
dig it.
I'm not into the original art market by and large. I've got like two or three pages of original art and that's it. And they were gifts from a friend and stuff, which I really value and such. That's one of those things where I think my wallet could really empty out if I go in that area. So I try
No, but that's not what I mean. You don't have to go spend. What I mean is the accessibility of the guys and
Exactly.
just being there and talking with these guys. I mean, that's kind of what I'm getting at. Oh, I believe me, man, I'm not getting into original art or pages or anything like that. I can't afford that. I can't afford another hobby in the comic sphere.
One of the ways, though, I judge a convention in terms of the artist alley and the small press area, are there artists, are there properties, are there comics that I am unfamiliar with that I think I should be buying?
Yeah, right.
Can I find something new? Now, I say that having already kind of prepped my spreadsheet for not the shipment I just got today, but for the one I hope to get Friday, where I've got like 64 items, new comics or whatever in the list. I don't need many more things on my list, but
Right.
if there's something cool to go read, I'll see if I can make room. But
Mm-hmm.
yeah, I'm looking forward to just some shopping opportunities, just to see what there is to see, just to like I said, do the C2E2 experience, see what it's all about. This just, you
And
know,
if nothing
things
more, it's a vacation, you know.
exactly. Things fell into place. It was easy to do this time around. I'm looking forward to it. So,
And you're still going to San Diego, right?
oh yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah.
And maybe what we should do is plan on doing an episode about C2E2 afterwards.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I'm gonna bring my recording equipment. We'll record down there too. I don't know how much recording we'll get done, but we'll get something done.
Yeah, we can do it
And
either there or after the fact. We'll do it as a roundtable or whatever on my podcast or something.
did you have trouble getting a San Diego ticket?
San Diego, I validated for press, so I had no problem.
Okay.
C2E2, I did not get validated with press, so I bought a ticket.
Okay.
So, you know, if I do coverage of C2E2, so be it. If I don't, I'm okay too, because I'm going there as a convention goer, because, like I said, didn't get a press badge. But, you know, hey,
Yeah.
them's the breaks.
'Cause I know a lot of guys were knocked out for San Diego, so it's just getting harder and harder to get a ticket.
That was one of the other reasons I wanted to check out C2E2, is if it gets to the point where San Diego is either impossible to get into or impossible to survive if I do get into it, having some other options. It's a great show, but I find that level of crowds just overwhelming, that level of noise influx, sensory overload, that kind of a thing. You know, I liked it better back when it was a little more sedate. But, you know, hey, that's just me. And it's so damn spread out, I just get tired.
Yeah, that's true too.
But yeah, no, should be a lot of fun. Should be a lot of
So,
fun.
awesome.
Anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
I think that'll do it, man.
Cool. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening. The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If they differ from your reality, please verify you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes 2 decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there is at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust it needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, list of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50, 25, or as few as 10 items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which, as far as I know now, has not been successfully invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic books, graphic novels, and/or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists is included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside the Diamond Comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer's here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the ultimate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Athlogic and the English language itself seem to work very differently there.